live by in this country and globally. But one of the biggest ones is that we have this crusading free press, fourth estate, which holds power to account. We don't at all. It operates 99% of the time as a arm of the state itself. And the other 1%, when they're actually doing critical stories, they're always surface scandals. They're nothing that tells you anything about the systematic workings of the British state. And definitely don't tell you anything about the secretive agencies, which have a lot of power in this country and basically never covered. So, it's been a pretty eye-opening experience covering this stuff. And also, the other thing, which I should mention, is Spyfire is only one component. And there's obviously the arms that have been going. 150,000 bullets were sent to Israel soon after October 7th, when the genocide started. They've been sending armored tanks, all sorts of different military equipment. They also have sent parts for the F-35 plane, which became controversial recently because they, when Labour announced a partial suspension of arms to Israel in September 2024, they carved out the parts for the F-35 jet, which 15% of which is produced in the UK, which is absurd. Because how can you say, well, our lawyers have said that any weapons that go to Israel that can be used in Gaza run the risk of being used in violations of international humanitarian law, and leave out the part, which is the parts for the main bit of technology which is carrying out that genocide? It doesn't make any sense on the legal terms. And in fact, there was a recent case which was lost insanely by two human rights groups to try and get the government to stop the F-35 parts. Anyway, then there's also the SAS, which again is not talked about at all. In fact, there was the only mention of the SAS in Gaza was in the mainstream media on October 27th. There was an article in The Sun, and this is how the SAS work. They're not against leaks, but they only do official leaks, and always there to present the SAS as this heroic institution. So in October 27th, 2023, there was an article in The Sun which was based on sources saying that the SAS had deployed to Cyprus for Gaza operations, heroic hostage rescue operations. The following day, a D-notice was sent out by the Ministry of Defence to all media to say you can't publish anything more about UK Special Forces in Gaza. To this day, there's not been a single bit of information which has come out in the media about what those Special Forces have been doing. I actually recently published that D-notice because I got hold of it. Again, it goes back to the media point. I mean, and means they're complicit. If they have information, have received information about our Special Forces being involved in Israel or on the ground in Gaza, it's not preposterous to think that could have happened. And they've not published it because they've been told by the Ministry of Defence that there's a D-notice. They're complicit because the D-notice is officially voluntary. So there's not even any punitive, I mean, there might be sort of like unofficial punitive measures that can be taken against newspapers, but the fact that we've had no more information, the fact that they kept that D-notice secret, the D-notice I published for the first time had gone to every single media editor in the UK, and not one thought it would be the right moral thing to publicise it. The only way we knew about its existence was a socialist worker wrote a story about it. They didn't publish the D-notice itself, but that was a big service in itself. But so it's deep, deep complicity. I don't think you can think of the Gaza genocide as just an Israeli genocide. It's and I say this all the time, so I'm sure people are bored of hearing it, but it is a tripartite genocide. It's the US, it's the UK, and it's Israel. Now, the US providing the vast majority of the arms, also Special Forces, by the way. It was reported early in the genocide that US Special Forces had been deployed to Israel. Britain providing the majority of the intelligence, it seems, or that's their role, and Israel getting it done and I'll finish with this, just on the spy flights where we started. Subsequent to the work we were doing, there was an investigation by Al Jazeera into reconnaissance flights over Gaza. This came out last year, 2024, and they found that 47% of all reconnaissance flights over Gaza were flown by the RAF, which was more than double Israel itself. So how are you not a party to a conflict if that's the stats that have been gathered from open source intelligence? And the UK government admits they're giving that intelligence to Israel. They don't say what departments or what it's for, what apart from hostage rescue, but to me there's no confusion. If we lived in a world which actually applied international law, UK ministers would be getting arrest warrants from the ICC now. And again, I should we talk a lot about Starmer and Lammy and John Healey, who's the defense secretary, but this also goes for the previous Conservative administration, who started the spy flights themselves. So Rishi Sunak, Grant Shapps, who was defense secretary, David Cameron, who was foreign secretary. So there's a whole coterie of war criminals that have served in the UK government and been complicit in, and participants, in fact, in one of the worst crimes in modern history, maybe of in all history. So it's going to take years of work to unravel the reality of what's happening, because, as I say, what we know now is the result of independent journalists using mostly open source stuff. So as soon as, over the years, when we get more whistleblowers, when we get more information, hopefully from legal cases and other avenues, we'll get a much more full understanding. And that's why I always say, like, this won't stop when the genocide finishes. This is a years of work that we're all going to be dedicated to, because we have to hold the people that are accountable for this to justice, because if we don't, then we just accept that we live in a genocidal world and the law of the jungle rules, and we can't accept that. So it's imperative to stop it happening again, but also just to stop the complete disintegration of our society, that we hold accountable the people that did this. And obviously, we have some hope in the ICC arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, because although they took too long, that's the first time Western leaders have been, and our allies have been prosecuted, despite us being the most violent and war criminal countries in the world. So the fact that that threshold was crossed means that the idea that our own Prime Minister or the US President, or on behalf of the US President, because they're not part of the ICC, but, you know, the people that we assume, and people would be shocked if you said they're going to be in the restaurant, we need to change that idea, and we need to say, we need to understand that the ICC was essentially created as an imperial tool, and it was created to go after official enemies, which is what it did up to the Gaza genocide.
I agree completely on that, and of course we praise you for the work that you've done in exposing all of this. I think because of your doggedness in pursuing the government on these sorts of matters, you were even blacklisted at one point by the UK Ministry of Defence.
Yeah, that was earlier on at Declassified. That was actually a very salutary tale of how the media system worked. That happened like about a year into us founding Declassified. And I did a story, basically, about how MI5 and MI6 were training spies from some of the worst dictatorships in the world, like the Saudis, the Egyptians, the UAE, at a base called Chicksands, just outside London. And, like always, I contacted the MOD for comment, because it was an MOD course that they were training them on. And they just didn't respond. And then I called them and they said, we'll get back to you, and they didn't respond. So I was very, like, sort of like, they never do this. This is the first time this has happened. And then a couple of weeks later, there was a protest by Ahmed Al-Batati. I don't know if you remember him. Yes. He was a Yemeni British soldier, but a British Yemeni, who was serving in the Ministry of Defence and went out in his fatigues outside the Ministry of Defence and blew a whistle every minute to symbolise how many Yemenis were dying because of the British war in Yemen, which it was a British war. It wasn't just a Saudi war. He got arrested by military police and then discharged. But anyway, when he was taken in, Phil Miller, my colleague, contacted the Ministry of Defence for comment about what had happened to him, what the process was, and they didn't get back to him. And then he called them again, and he was recording the call, and the officer and the press officer said, oh, we don't deal with your publication anymore. Which is a contravention of the civil service code, by the way, because you're meant to, you have to interact with all journalists despite their political affiliations or style of journalism. And then they probably thought, well, this is a small website, nothing's going to happen. But it escalated, and a Council of Europe media alert was sent out, level 2, which is quite a big deal, and also means, because the Council of Europe, the UK's part of, meant that the Ministry of Defence had to respond. So anyway, Ben Wallace, who was then Defence Secretary, ordered a inquiry, which was carried out by Tony Blair's former spokesperson, not Alistair Campbell, another one. And he published a report which showed essentially that we'd been backlisted. But yet Ben Wallace still didn't accept that there was a blacklisting in his place. He said it appeared to many people in the Prif office that it was a blacklisting. It was just like legalese. But the interesting thing was he that whole report, which was quite shocking, by the way, it was like anonymous military officers said we need to put them on a list of hostile media organizations. You don't know what that means within the context. So they published that report, which was a long report, very, very shocking and worrying for the Free Press. Ben Wallace gets up in the House of Commons, apologizes to Declassified UK, which is kind of unprecedented, and still to this day, not a single word about it has ever appeared in the mainstream media, which is crazy, because when you talk about that level of response, like you would imagine, and the Council of Europe, you expect that the mainstream media, who you would think would defend fellow journalists who are actually doing proper work, unlike them, they didn't. But that was, again, it goes to show that the Ministry of Defence just did not know how to deal with journalists who, I mean, and they still are, don't take any state or corporate funding, completely independent, not working for any hostile powers or anything. But they just couldn't accept journalists, or didn't understand journalists that were asking questions in a critical way to try and find out information that the government didn't want out. Like, literally, if you look at the main defence correspondents from, like, Jonathan Beale at the BBC, Deborah Haynes at Sky News, nearly everything they publish is just a reworded MOD press release. It's shocking.
Well, Jonathan Beale recently decried the reporting on these spy flights. I think he attacked Des Friedman and also maybe John McAvoy at Declassified for reporting on it. And he asked, I'm paraphrasing, whether they had access to some secretive, privileged information. And it's like, well, this is all publicly sourced. If you're doing your job, you'd have also discovered this.
It's a mindset. That's the interesting thing. That's my take on a propaganda system. It's not that he is being controlled. It's just that he has not ever got in his head an idea that he wants to find out information that the government doesn't want out. Because he's so immersed in that mainstream media world, especially at the BBC, where you're just an appendage of the state, that the thought to actually maybe do a bit of independent research never crosses his mind. It's that Noam Chomsky interview with Andrew Marr, you know, when Andrew Marr says, do you believe I don't think what I say? And he said, no, you think what you say, but you wouldn't be where you are if you thought any different. So anyone who does critical journalism gets filtered out way before they get to the level of Jonathan Beale. And that's the way it works. And that's why it's quite funny when they respond like that, because they're not aware of it. They always say, well, I can write what I want, and I can do what I want. It's like, well, that's because you never say anything that the state doesn't like. If you did, you'd soon find out that they wouldn't allow you to continue. But but as you say, I mean, you said active participants. I'd say they're complicit, definitely, because if you, like, to go back to the F-35 September 2024 suspensions by Labour, right, that only happened because when the media has focused on UK role, it's always on arms, which is good. Like, obviously, I think there should be a complete arms embargo. There should have been one a long time ago. But the government was pressured by that media pressure and mainstream media pressure. If that mainstream media had borne that pressure on the spy flights, they would have been grounded a year ago or more.
Well, also, just speaking of complicity, you recently broke a story that numerous Israeli jets have been active in perpetrating the Gaza genocide have been landing in Britain.
Yeah, mad. Again, not picked up at all by the mainstream media, as it never is. But yeah, is active participation, because these are Israeli tankers. They're called Reem air-to-air refueling planes. Yeah, they landed at Bryce Norton 9 times. At least, that's what we could find. I'm sure there's more. But they landed at RAF Bryce Norton, all under the Labour government. And then days later, on some occasions, they were flying off Gaza, refueling fighter jets, when there were massacres of nearly 100 people in one in Beit Lahia. And it just got. And then recently, the head of the Israeli Air Force came and attended the air tattoo at a UK military base. This is a guy that is basically the architect of, in terms of the air war, of the genocide, and he's been welcomed by the Labour government. It is astounding, the level of complicity and participation. And it goes to the fact that I think that effectively we are occupied by the Israeli state in many ways through different mechanisms. One is the official Israel lobby, like the Israeli embassy and its various different agencies, but also through the groups they have within our political system, like Labour Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, which are front groups for the embassy, both of whom don't reveal their funders. But you know, in that Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby, Michael Rubin, who was then the parliamentary officer for the LFI, was recorded outside a pub saying, well, we work closely with the embassy and they send us things to say when there's trouble for Israel. So effectively, everything you see posted, every statement you see posted by LFI is probably drafted by the Israeli embassy, highly likely. That's one section. Then there's the other section, which is nominally Jewish groups that are meant to represent Jewish interests or Jewish communal interests that have been infiltrated by the Israeli embassy and the Zionist movement and made to work, like the Jewish labor movement. There's not hard evidence of links to the embassy, although Ella Rose was at the Israeli embassy and then became head of Jewish labor movement, I think. But it's clear from their statements that they're basically operating as an Israel lobby group. Same with the
Well, I mean, even in the Jewish labor movement constitution, they're bound to support Israel.
Exactly. Yeah, and the Board of Deputies of British Jews, right, which is again presents itself as a Jewish communal group representing the community in Britain. It's explicitly an Israel lobby group, because if you look at the parliamentary records of ministers' meetings, they say the Board of Deputies is coming in, and what do they say they're talking about? Israel-Palestine, and they're arguing the case for Israel. It's see-through. So you've got that element as well. And then you've got the media that is smear, and that these organizations play a role. But the other way that we're occupied is there's various mechanisms that can be used to stop the ascent of a leader who might take decisions which are to the detriment of Israel, which we saw very clearly with Jeremy Corbyn. And he gets criticized for not being radical enough on his Israel policy, which, fair enough, I agree with that. But in both manifestos, he said there would be an arms embargo on Israel in terms of weapons that could be used in human rights violations against Palestinians. Like, that was completely unprecedented. I don't think it ever appeared in the mainstream. And how was he destroyed? One of the main mechanisms was that the bogus anti-Semitism campaign, which began as soon as he was elected leader. So
well, before that, actually.
Huh? Well, before that. And actually, Ed Miliband, who was the leader before Corbyn, he also came under, because he wanted to recognize Palestine. People forget this whole episode. And there was a whole fake anti-Semitism thing around him as well. So there's various mechanisms, which mean it's very, very hard, in fact, maybe impossible, for the British state and its different agencies, like the military, to put a hand up and say, no, it's Israel. And that's just the proof's in the pudding. If we're inviting a guy who's the head of the Air Force, when his boss, the Prime Minister, has an ICC arrest warrant out to the UK to talk for meetings, that something's wrong. If we're allowing the Israeli planes that are involved in the bombing of Gaza, which has been orchestrated by a Prime Minister who's got an ICC arrest warrant out, how that doesn't make sense in any way unless to say that the British state is not acting in its own interest or in our interest. It goes, I mean, there's another example I've looked into, which is the prescription thing, right? Prescription of Palestine Action was pushed by the Israel lobby. Prescription of Hezbollah was pushed by the Israel lobby. Both those things, I think, if even the British establishment had control over the things, wouldn't have done. One, because Palestine Action is so preposterous, it's just, it's become unworkable and it's an embarrassment now. On the Hezbollah thing, they got two ministers in the Lebanese government. The British government don't want to, in terms of British national interest, they don't want to alienate and make it impossible to negotiate, to deal with people in positions of power
This is why I think, you know, Britain has lost a lot of its diplomatic capital around the world, particularly through this prescription regime, which is why global diplomacy now doesn't happen out of London, it happens out of Doha in Qatar.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Thank you.
afternoon to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, "Allah is beautiful and loves beauty." Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. And the continuation of Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with Black and White. The program covers the latest developments in Latin America and tells you what is happening in this strategically important region. Spring of Truth will follow next. This program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. And we finish off this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
Black and White.
The greatness of a nation, the greatness of its people, is not defined by its size, the weapons it possesses, the money held in international banks, or the skyscrapers it boasts. Instead, it's determined by the resolve of its people to pursue a fair policy that benefits themselves and all of humanity, and to stand in solidarity with those fighting for sovereignty and independence. This is exemplified by Yemen and its people, who teaches daily what it means to support a nation that is being attacked, massacred, and starved, much like the Palestinian people. The Yemenis have embraced the Palestinian cause as their own, bearing the consequences of this stance, as the imperialists and Zionists do not remain passive.
No se quedan impávidos. Por el contrario.
On the contrary, they bomb various ports in Yemen and commit acts of murder. Nevertheless, Yemen does not kneel. It responds decisively and effectively against Israeli territory, targeting airports, ports, and even U.S. and British aircraft carriers and other ships in the Red Sea. Yemen prevents any cargo intended for the Zionist entity from passing through its waters. They have sunk ships, so what greater demonstration of solidarity exists today for the peace on earth? Who can show greater solidarity than this?
¿Quién puede mostrar mayor solidaridad que esa que un pueblo no muy numeroso?
A small community, not particularly wealthy and facing significant challenges in life, is nonetheless capable of feeling the pain of others, embracing it as their own and making the struggles of others their own cause. To speak of Yemen today is to speak of the awareness of solidarity that exists in the world, as these are not mere polite statements or temporary declarations. They are tangible actions that involve their own blood, their own lives. This is surely something that the youth and communities around the world must be embracing. Look at that small country, that not-so-numerous population, brave as they come, unlike any other at this moment.
Valiente como el que más, como ningún otro, en este instante, que nos muestra de que es posible.
Showing us that it is possible and necessary to stand up against the great imperialist powers, against the entire collective West, against the Zionist entity, to prevent them from carrying out their massacres of the peoples.
Su injerencia sobre los mismos y al mismo tiempo vencer. Eso es el yin.
Their interference in their affairs, and at the same time, to triumph. That is Yemen. It is struggle, solidarity, the determination to win, and the commitment to bring about the changes our times demand. The mainstream media can say whatever it wants, can make a fool of itself as always, talking about a people in rags from the desert, who have nothing to eat, yet they get involved in other people's conflicts, because it's not happening to them. They're not Palestinians, and since they're not Palestinians, they shouldn't be involved. However, they build their weapons and use them against a common enemy. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. ¿Qué es el Yemen? ¿Qué fuerza tiene ese pueblo?
What is Yemen? What strength do these people possess to constantly confront Western powers and the Zionist entity? They embarrass them, attacking their destroyers and aircraft carriers, making some flee at times, striking at the heart of the Zionist entity that occupies Palestinian lands. Where does this strength come from? What is the role? How can a country and a people like that make a series of puppet Arab governments blush with shame, unable to show solidarity and stand by Palestine? Today we will discuss this here on Black and White with Nicola Hadwa from the city of Valparaiso, an international analyst responsible for international relations at the Chilean Committee for Solidarity with Palestine. Welcome to our program, Black and White, Nicola Hadwa.
It's a pleasure, Eduardo, an honor and a joy to be part of such an important and interesting program like yours. So I'm here at your complete disposal.
Nicola, in the introduction, I raised the question of where that ability, that passion, that strength, and that courage of the Yemenis comes from, which the dominant Western media often portrays as desert terrorists.
Del desierto.
Claro. Todo enemigo del imperio, Eduardo. Of course, every enemy of the empire, Eduardo, every foe of Zionism has to deal with their vast misinformation capabilities, which they control. To give you an idea, they manage 52,000 multinational corporations, and within those, they oversee hundreds in the information sector, but in this instance, it pertains to misinformation. We need to get used to the fact, Eduardo, that whatever comes from the West, to illustrate it better, out of every 10 words, 15 are lies. Therefore, reading the Western press is not only pointless, but also a way to poison oneself and become misinformed. The Yemeni people are a historic nation recognized through our history for being an indomitable people, never humiliated, never defeated. Their sense of national dignity and their concept of a struggle are deeply rooted in the popular masses. You see, there was an aggression, which we can discuss later, from the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and the criminal Israeli entity that commits infanticide, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, supported by Egypt and Sudan, against the poorest Arab country, and yet they could not defeat it and had to leave in disgrace. So we're facing the poorest country in the Arab world, yet it stands out as the most dignified among a region filled with feudal monarchies and treacherous regimes. Yemen and Algeria are currently holding their heads high for the dignity of the Arab peoples, which includes all Arab and Islamic nations, and we must also acknowledge the heroic stance taken by the people and government of Iran.
Nicola, what could we say about the role that the people of Yemen have played, not just ideologically and politically, but in shaking the consciousness of the entire Arab and Muslim world? What specific role have they had in striking against the targets of the Zionist entity and those who collaborate with them, including the United States itself?
El rol que ha jugado Eduardo es impresionante.
Well, Eduardo, the role that Yemen has played is truly impressive. It's remarkable because that country, which seemed unknown to the West and to the popular masses in the West, suddenly emerges on the global geopolitical and geostrategic map as a nation of tremendous significance. The United States goes in with two aircraft carriers, the largest, most complex, and modern ones, along with eight destroyers and frigates, to threaten and attack Yemen in order to assist in protecting the criminal, child-killing entity that is Israel. Notice that, shortly after, one of the aircraft carriers suffered a severe blow, while the other took a moderate hit. Some ships were hit by missiles and had to quickly leave the Arabian Sea and exit the Red Sea, because they realized that Yemen's weapons can reach them. Weapons that, by the way, they built with their own hands. On the other hand, Yemen created a very important maritime blockade, a blockade in the Arabian Sea, in the Gulf of Aden, and in the Red Sea, against the criminal child-killing Zionist entity. This blockade was quite effective, but unfortunately, through land routes, the treacherous feudal monarchies and the Arab collaborators, the reactionary Arabs, created a land corridor to supply the Zionist child-killing entity with the necessary products. Indeed, Yemen was and still is by far the strongest, most determined, and best ally, as well as the most effective ally that the Palestinian people have had.
Let's take a break and continue right away, Nicola. Thank you very much. We're back here with Nicola Hadwa for a powerful interview about this incredible country and its wonderful people called Yemen. Nicola, you were discussing how it has humiliated the collective West, as we might say, and they have been forced to take measures to transport their products through alternative routes, which also means higher costs. That's already a victory, by the way. Please continue with what you were saying.
Por favor, continúa en lo que estabas relatando.
Bueno, sí. Yemen logró imponer una ecuación nueva.
Well, yes. Yemen managed to establish a new equation and show that the Israeli child-killing entity was not an invincible army. It was, in fact, a considerably weaker army and country. Unfortunately, those who do the dirty work for this criminal entity are the Arab reactionaries. When Syria, supported by Iraqi militias, was about to enter and open the front to the Golan Heights, the feudal monarchies, along with the Turkish traitors, took it upon themselves to overthrow the Syrian government to prevent them from opening the front to the Golan Heights against Israel. When Hezbollah was delivering a massive beating to the Zionists in southern Lebanon, remember that on the first day of the attack, Eduardo, the first day the criminal Zionist entity attempted to enter Lebanon, it lost 30% of its attacking force and failed to advance even 10 meters. I mean, we need to know that the defeat inflicted by Hezbollah was at such a level. Well, then the Arab reactionaries, with a pro-colonial government, which we could say is recolonized and closely allied with imperialism, threatened Hezbollah with a civil war if they did not agree to a ceasefire with the criminal regime of Israel. In the case of the Palestinians, when the front in Jordan was about to open, the Palestinian National Authority, along with the Zionist agents, mainly Mahmoud Abbas, took it upon themselves to suppress the Palestinian people, the resistance battalions located in Tulkarem, Nablus, and Jenin, arresting many and handing them over to the Israeli child-killing regime. In other words, the Arabs and the Arab reactionaries, they have been the ones doing the dirty work for the Israeli criminal entity. In the case of Yemen, the empire tasked Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates with trying to suffocate Yemen in an operation that involved the British, French, and American troops, along with the entire Saudi military and the forces of the worst traitors in the Arab world, the United Arab Emirates, who managed to occupy the province of Ma'arib in Yemen. The province of Ma'arib is home to all of Yemen's oil and gas reserves, aiming to cripple its economy. Nevertheless, Yemen stood firm, defeating the occupying forces, overcoming Saudi Arabia, and pushing out many of the imperial British and French soldiers. The Yemeni people are impoverished, I must reiterate, but they are fierce fighters who do not know the meaning of defeat or surrender.
Ni conocen la palabra rendición, Eduardo.
Así es. Nicola, algunos analistas dicen...
Indeed, Nicola, some analysts suggest that there is an exodus of settlers fleeing from the occupied Palestine, citing one of the reasons as the ongoing and persistent missiles and drones coming from Yemen that keep them in a state of anxiety and alertness. In fact, in an analysis I read, it mentioned that the shrapnel that sometimes falls even on the beach prevents them from enjoying their summer, from being by the sea, basking in the sun, and they have to leave because the shrapnel falls around them, which puts them in a state of nervousness and fear. What do you think about the significance of these bombings that may seem small and insignificant, yet are constant?
Insignificante, pero constantes.
De toda la guerra que ha habido ahora, aparte de...
Throughout the ongoing war, aside from the bravery displayed by the Palestinian resistance, which has notably dealt significant blows to the Israeli occupying army in Gaza, consider that they have been fighting for 2 years without being able to defeat the Palestinian resistance. Zionist military analysts claim that the strength of the resistance is only growing. It's worth mentioning that the actions of the Zionist regime mirror those of the Nazis, who, when their soldiers faced defeat, turned to attack the civilian population. What actions is the Zionist regime taking? This regime cannot exist in peace, nor can it thrive in war. Yemen, with its meticulously calculated, well-defined, and carefully planned attacks, has contributed significantly alongside the Palestinian resistance. This is crucial, and I will elaborate a bit more. The fact is that 1.5 million people have emigrated from the occupied territories, and the majority, over 70%, are young individuals who refuse to join the army. They have come to realize that this war is not going to end soon. They understand that they are as vulnerable as the innocent Palestinian civilians. For instance, you can observe that currently 2 or 3 fighters arrive daily from Tel Aviv to Buenos Aires, bringing along the Zionist child killers. This war has uprooted, as I mentioned, 1.5 million occupiers, but what are the implications of this? Not only the fear and the evacuation of occupants from Palestine, which has led the United States and European powers to speak up and reveal their concerns, but we could also say that there is a rapid recognition of the Palestinian state. However, this is aimed at saving the Zionist regime from a definitive and total collapse. Why? 66,000 businesses have gone bankrupt. There are no workers. And the evangelical zealots who are used as cannon fodder to fight against their own Christian brothers have not been enough to get the productive machine running. The banking system is paralyzed, commerce is at a standstill, they cannot meet their international commitments, and they are unable to fix the economy. The most optimistic say that this criminal entity, Israel, could recover in 10 years. The number of Jews coming to Israel have dropped to zero. Consequently, the Israeli regime is becoming completely unviable. On one hand, the Israeli occupiers have realized that their regime was serving transnational corporations and American imperialism rather than their own people, who spoke of a Jewish land meant only for the Jews. Well, they came to understand that they were sending their young men to die. They let them perish and even killed themselves. I mean, whenever they had the chance to eliminate an Israeli captive at the hands of the Hamas fighters, they did so. When an Israeli soldier is captured, the Air Force goes in and bombs the area to kill that soldier, and also the members of the Palestinian resistance. Thus, they have recognized that the regime does not care about the Jewish people or the so-called Jewish land at all. What truly matters to them is the interests of transnational corporations and supporting American imperialism.
Nicola, tú pusiste un punto muy importante al inicio.
You made a very important point at the beginning just now. You mentioned that the movement seen in various European countries to recognize and establish a Palestinian state is either a salvation or an attempt to preserve the occupying Zionist entity. Please elaborate a bit more on that, as it is quite significant.
Of course, that's the most important thing. Right now, the United States and NATO, having seen all their plans fail, are moving on to another plan, hoping the Arabs will do the dirty work for the Israeli criminal entity. There is talk of quickly recognizing the Palestinian state. The Palestinian National Authority is not just some treacherous collaborators. In fact, the Palestinian Authority is like a second Israel. Those collaborators would be responsible for managing Gaza and the West Bank. Here, the criminal Israel has become divided. The majority does not want the Palestinian Authority to govern either Gaza or the West Bank, and the parliament has agreed to annex all of the West Bank. Therefore, this plan could fail just like the French plans of Charles de Gaulle, which were undermined by the most reactionary elements in Algeria, namely the OAS. So, in this case, once this figurative state is created and accepted, which would have no army, whose economy is intertwined with Israel and which lacks clear borders, it is ultimately a foolish idea that only the United States and Israel could conceive. Once the Palestinian Authority wishes to enter Gaza, then the Arab League would be responsible for forming an army, supported by the Zionist army, equipped to enter Gaza and defeat the resistance that the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, with their child-killing Zionist army, have been unable to overcome, as they have all been defeated. I mention this because there are American, French, and British border soldiers, official troops who are there and have died. And among them, more than 50 Americans have lost their lives.
Nada más que norteamericanos han muerto más de 50.
Así es, Nicola. Bueno, el tiempo aquí es brutal.
That's right, Nicola. I really appreciate your remarks, and it's clear how important the struggle of the Yemeni people is, along with their courageous attitude and a solidarity towards the Palestinian people, serving as an example for all countries that claim to be sovereign. Thank you so much, Nicola, for being with us here on Black and White.
Thanks. It's a pleasure and honor for me to be part of such a great program that you host, Eduardo. Thank you.
Thank you.
انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters in faith who are listening to IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad. I'm the host of this show. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the sayings of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, that is very influential, and we can learn many lessons from that. He says, be certain that if your activities are not based on Allah, that is, they are not based on something that's divine, okay, and it is not something that guarantees Islamic unity, you will become wretched, basically, that's what he said. You will become makhdool. Makhdool means you will become misfortunate and wretched, probably both in this world and the hereafter. So it's really important how we live and what intention we have. We have to make sure that all of our activities, it doesn't matter what we do, even if it's something that we don't consider Islamic or something religious, we can still have Allah in mind and have a godly intention, right? In fact, one of the things that Imam Khomeini, another thing he has said is that even the things that are mubah, right? Things that no punishment or reward determined for those activities, okay? But if you make your intention Islamic and for Allah, for example, you're saying that, okay, I'm going to eat my food so that I have enough energy to worship Allah, to do things for Allah. I'm going to sleep so that I will wake up refreshed and have the energy to do all kinds of good deeds, okay? So that is why everything that we do, whether it's Islamic or not, whether we think it entails reward or punishment, it does or it doesn't entail reward or punishment, we should still strive so that it is for Allah. If you do things just for Allah, just from now on, just say that whatever I do, whether it's wajib, whether it's mubah, whether it's halal, whether it's mustahab, whatever, okay, as long as it's not a sin, okay, as long as it's not a sin, it's for Allah. If you do that, your life is definitely gonna change.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Along the winding and beautiful road, we're heading towards the city of Tuisercan, that's enclosed by green and picturesque valleys. A city that was built atop the ruins of an old town destroyed during the Mongol invasion of Eurasia. Tuisercan is in the province of Hamedan in western Iran, about 5 or 6 hours' drive from Tehran. The weather at our destination is mild and pleasant for this time of year, but since the city is surrounded by the Zagros Mountains, it can become very cold at night and at winter times. Because of its vast walnut orchards, Tuisercan is known as the hub of Persian walnut. But that aside, all the things I'm going to show you will point to the rich historical background and culture of this city.
Mansions that has stood the passage of time since the Qajar period is this two-story building, the Masudi House, named after the actual residence, and it's now a museum. Come on, let's go inside.
The most eye-catching thing in the entire house is the chamber on the first floor where guests were entertained. The entire ceiling and walls of this room are covered with stucco, mirrorwork, paintings and motifs depicting the kings of old Persia, scenes from the Shahnameh or Book of Kings. But this is not the only attraction of the house. If you take a look around, you can easily breathe in the beauty that lies here.
You can imagine that house was considered to be a grand house about 130 years ago when it was commissioned. The people who lived here were the descendants of a Qajar prince called Abbas Mirza.
The Masudi House isn't the only historical monument in Tuisercan. There are still plenty more left, and we're going to visit as many as we can.
If you search for the city of Tuisercan on the internet, one of the first images you'll come across is a photograph of this mausoleum. This is where Habakkuk, one of the prophets in the Hebrew Bible, actually the 8th of the 12 minor prophets, was put to rest.
It's not only because of Habakkuk that this shrine is valuable. The architecture that has allowed this 12-meter-high mausoleum to survive some 900 years is also astonishing. From afar, it appears to have an octagonal form with the cone-shaped roof comprising 16 columns arranged in an interesting way. It is this architectural form that has allowed it to stand firm against storms and earthquakes. Tuisercan's attractions aren't limited to man-made and historical sites. Apparently, there's more. Some of the locals gave us directions to a location that's home to one of the oldest living trees in Iran. The 2,000-year-old Barvar sycamore tree. I'd hazard a guess that it's about 35 meters high, and it has a really thick trunk. Tuzerkan is filled with old and resilient trees, most of which are walnut trees. Tuzerkan is famous for its top quality walnut trees, so we've come to this walnut orchard to find out what all the fuss is about. Walnuts actually grow inside a green husk inside which you have a hard brown walnut shell. The meat's inside the shell, of course. The first step in harvesting walnuts is to actually get them off the trees, and the easiest way to do that is by shaking the branches. And in Tuzerkan, it's done the traditional way. The locals usually wait for the walnuts to ripen and for the husks to change color before they do this, because then they are able to shake the walnuts loose without harming the tree.